Read in God's most holy word in the Old Testament and the prophecy of Daniel chapter 8, the 8th chapter of the prophecy of Daniel, which you find the first of the smaller prophets after Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. Daniel chapter 8, Daniel's vision of a ram, that is, the Medo-Persian Empire, Cyrus, and a goat, that is, hundreds of years later on, the kingdom of Alexander the Great, the Greek, who brought the Greek language to Palestine so that the New Testament should be written not in Hebrew like the Old Testament, but in Greek. In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had a vision after the one that had already appeared to me. In my vision, I saw myself in the citadel of Susa, in the province of Elam, that is beyond the Persian Gulf, whereas, of course, the vision took place in Babylon, but he saw himself in this palace of the Medo-Persian king. In the vision, I was beside the Ulai Canal. I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, as the Medo-Persian kingdom, these two kingdoms were unequal, but grew up later. I watched the ram as he charged towards the west and the north and the south. No animal could stand against him, and none could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. It was this Cyrus, the first king of the Medo-Persian Empire, who sent the Jews back to Jerusalem and Judah after their 70 years captivity. He was far from the worst of these great emperors. As I was thinking about this, says Daniel, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between his eyes came from the west, from Greece actually, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground, the speed of Alexander's conquest. He came towards the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal and charged at him in great rage. I saw him attack the lamb furiously, striking the ram and shattering his two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against him. The goat knocked him to the ground and trampled on him, and none could rescue the ram from his power. The goat became very great, but at the height of his power, he reigned for less than 10 years and died a young man. But at the height of his power, his large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up toward the four winds of heaven. After his sudden death in Babylon, his kingdom was divided into four: Syria, Egypt, Greece, and the kingdom toward the east. Out of one of these horns came another horn, which started small but grew in power to the south and to the east and toward the beautiful land, Judea. It grew until it reached the host of heavens, and it threw some of the starry host down to the earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. It took away the daily sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was brought low. This refers to the persecution of the Jews in the 2nd century B.C. by that horrid Antiochus Epiphanes. Because of rebellion, the host of the saints and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to him, "How long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? The vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation," or as in the Authorized Version, "the abomination of desolation," when Antiochus sacrificed the unclean pig on the altar at Jerusalem. And Jesus, of course, speaks of the abomination of desolation and the surrender of the sanctuary and of the host that will be trampled underfoot. He said to me, "It will take 2,300 evenings and mornings." Then the sanctuary. And of course, you divide that by 2 to get the number of days. Then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated. This is, of course, 3.5 years, 42 months, 1,260 days, and so many other numbers associated with this whole idea of the persecution of the Lord's people. An idea that starts with Abraham and runs right through to the end of the Bible. So we are not dealing this morning with anything obscure, although it's complex. While I, Daniel, was watching the vision and trying to understand it, there before me stood one who looked like a man, and I heard a man's voice from the Ulai calling, "Gabriel, tell this man the meaning of the vision." As he came near the place where I was standing, I was terrified and fell prostrate. "Son of man," he said to me, "understand that the vision concerns the time of the end." While he was speaking to me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, as Abraham was, you remember, when God spoke to him in Genesis chapter 15. Then he touched me and raised me to my feet. He said, "I am going to tell you what will happen later in the time of wrath, because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. The two-horned ram that you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia. The shaggy goat is the king of Greece, and the large horn between his eyes is the first king. The four horns that replace the one that was broken off represent four kingdoms that will emerge from his kingdom but will not have the same power. In the latter part of their reign, when rebels have become completely wicked, a stern-faced king, a master of intrigue, will arise. He will become very strong, but not by his own power, satanic in fact. He will cause astounding devastation and will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy the mighty men and the holy people. He will cause deceit to prosper, and he will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the Prince of Princes, Messiah, in fact. Yet, this you might say is the man of sin, yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. This, of course, refers to Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. The vision of the evenings and mornings that has been given you is true. But seal up the vision. That's to say, that's all that's to be told you meantime, for it concerns the distant future. That is to say, it not only referred to the years 168 to 165 BC, when Judas Maccabeus overturned the Syrians and drove them out of the land, but to the distant future, even to the end of the age. I, Daniel, was naturally exhausted and lay ill for several days. Then I got up and went about the king's business. I was appalled by the vision. It was beyond understanding. Amen. May God bless to us his most holy word. The Old Testament, the book of Daniel, chapter 8. Chapters 2 and 7 of the prophecy of Daniel are alike, in that each portrays the same four kingdoms. Chapter 2, under the figure gold, silver, bronze, and iron mixed with clay, the Roman Empire. And chapter 7, four beasts, the lion, the bear, the leopard, and that indescribably fierce monster representing the Roman Empire and all empires succeeding. These four kingdoms with their kings are the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Greek, and the Roman kingdom. And they cover the broadest historical sweep of the book of the prophecy of Daniel, whereas chapter 8 deals with only two of these kingdoms, the Medo-Persian and the Greek, although it looks forward and hints toward the Roman Empire and all empires that follow that, even unto the evil empires of our own day and those that may arise after our day. In the third year of Belshazzar, Daniel's vision saw himself not in Babylon at all, but in Susa, or Shushan, beyond the Persian Gulf, in Elam. But he sees himself there 60 to 80 years on, about the time that Ezra was sent to Jerusalem. The Medo-Persian Empire had then been going for 60, 70 years and was to last altogether for over 200 years until the sudden rise of Alexander the Great, the Greek conqueror. So Daniel saw this ram with two horns, which together represent the kingdom which Cyrus formed of the Medes and Persians, whose kingdom in its day, as verse 4 of our chapter says, was invincible and impregnable. And that is about all that the chapter says of the Medo-Persian kingdom, which Daniel is envisaging, as I say, 60 or 70 years before it began. So most of the chapter has to do with the rise of the goat, the he-goat, Alexander the Great, and his kingdom, the kingdom which, as I said during the reading, brought the Greek language to Palestine so that the New Testament was written in Greek, not Hebrew, like the Old Testament. Alexander's reign, well over 200 years ahead, in 331 BC was very short. So the vision also envisages four heads under whom Alexander's empire was divided after his sudden demise as a young man. Now, Alexander, son of Philip of Macedonia, was a great conqueror, and in a few days swept from his native Greece, through Asia Minor, or Turkey, down through Palestine into Egypt, and thence took in the whole of the Persian Empire, right to the gates of India, before he returned to Babylon to die, a young man, and all in less than 10 years. Think of the influence of that Greek kingdom on the world, even to the New Testament written in Greek. Alexander's kingdom, so suddenly bereft of its charismatic king, was divided into four, and for the next 200 years, power vacillated between one or other of these four powers: Greece, Asia Minor, Syria, and Egypt. But especially Syria and Egypt, with, of course, the Jewish remnant clinging to Judah and Jerusalem in the middle, the buffer of both Syria in the north and Egypt in the south. Now, this is really what this message is about. The rise of the Syrian kingdom of the Seleucids, as they are called, S-E-L-E-U-C-I-D-S, the Seleucids, the Syrian kingdom with its capital at Damascus, the rise of that kingdom following domination by the Egyptian kingdom from the death of Alexander in 331 to 198 BC, during which time Jews flocked to Alexandria in Egypt, where a great school of Jewish scholarship arose, including Philo, with a library which aimed to contain every book in the world. And it was at Alexandria where the Old Testament was translated into Greek, the Old Testament translated into Greek by the 70 scholars called the Septuagint. But after the Syrian Antiochus III conquered Palestine and took it from the Egyptians, his successor was the odious Antiochus IV, named Epiphanes, who took the throne in 175 BC and began to persecute the Jews. And this chapter is practically the only direct reference to this in the Bible, since the last date otherwise recorded in the Old Testament is at least 400 years before Christ, Zechariah and Malachi. We are therefore indebted to the two books of the Maccabees, the two books of the Maccabees in the Apocrypha, that is, out with the Bible, for news of what took place during this persecution. The only news we have beyond the hints in our chapter at these verses. Let's look at them again. 9 to 14. Chapter 8, 9 to 14. Out of one of them came another horn, which started small, but grew in power to the south and to the east and toward the beautiful land, Judea and Jerusalem. It grew until it reached the host of the heavens, and it threw some of the starry host down to the earth and trampled on them. it set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. Another reference to the Jews and the prospect of their coming Messiah. It took away the daily sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was brought low. Because of rebellion, the host of the saints and the daily sacrifice of the temple in Jerusalem were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. Then the end of the chapter, verses 23, in the latter part of their reign, when rebels have become completely wicked, a stern-faced king, a master of intrigue, will arise. He will become very strong, but not by his own power, but by satanic power. He will cause astounding devastation throughout Judea and Jerusalem, and will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy the mighty men and the holy people of God. He will cause deceit to prosper, and he will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the Prince of Princes, the predicted Messiah. Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. Well then, it was in 171 B.C. that Antiochus Epiphanes began seriously to interfere with the priesthood in Jerusalem. And in 168 began that fierce onslaught on the temple, which culminated in Antiochus sacrificing unclean animals on the holy altar of the Lord. And it was not until 165, 3.5 years afterwards, that Judas Maccabeus arose in revolt against these blasphemies and was able to rid the country of the vile influence. The temple was cleansed and reconsecrated for proper Jewish worship and sacrifices. But mind you, it was not until 142 B.C., long after Judas Maccabeus had died, that the country became truly independent of either Egypt or Syria. However, to turn back to our chapter and the hints about this dreadful persecutor of the Jews, there are expressions used in our chapter which seem to view the Jewish remnant and their situation in Jerusalem in a kind of holy light. For example, verse 9, the beautiful land, is a remarkable description of Jews clinging to the rock of Zion as a pathetic remnant, the beautiful land. And in verse 11, the prince of the host, with the prince of princes in verse 25. And we have to ask, what do these superlative expressions refer to and mean? Ah, but there is also in verse 13 the expression, the rebellion that causes desolation, or as we know it in the authorized version, the abomination of desolation, and the cessation of morning and evening sacrifices in the temple for the 1,150 days, half of 2,300 twice daily sacrifices, which roughly corresponds to the 3.5 years of the Jews' affliction from 168 to 165 B.C. We have also had in an earlier chapter, 7:25, this phrase, a time, times, and half a time, you see. And the 3 years of drought in Elijah's day, James 5 and 17 says 3.5 years, then scattered in the book of the Revelation, we have in 11 to 42 months, And in verse 11:3, 1,260 days. And again in Revelation 12 and 6, 1,260 days. In Revelation 12:14, again, a time, times, and half a time. And in Revelation 12 and 5, 42 months. All of these, scattered throughout the scriptures, represent 3.5 years. But what do these 3.5 years mean? They are years of the persecution of the Lord's people. As in Jerusalem from 168 to 165 BC, so throughout history, as the prelude to God's victorious blessing of his people. Indeed, the idea goes back to Genesis 15:12, when Abraham, like Daniel, fell into a deep sleep, and the Lord revealed to him that Israel would go into captivity to a foreign land until the iniquity of the Amorites was full, and then God would bring them out with a high hand from Egypt. So you see, this idea of 3.5 years and 3.5 years, one representing persecution, the other deliverance, is obviously a pervasive idea throughout Scripture. For you see, 3.5 is half of the perfect number 7. That's the point. And surely stands in any age, for those periods of the persecution of the Lord's people before he comes to liberate and bless them. It could stand for the sufferings of Christians in Russia, Soviet Russia, until their present liberation, or stand for sufferings of Christians under Nazism, or whatever. Or our dear friend Sammy Dagger, the pastor of that marvelous church in the midst of Beirut, that has survived all the bombing and the shelling. And then, of course, that's what Jesus is talking about in Matthew 24, verses 15 and 16. Look it up. Matthew 24, 15 and 16. Which ultimately stands, you see, Jesus is speaking about it, ultimately stands for the final apostasy, the last revolt, the revolt of evil, before Christ comes a second time in power and glory to deliver and glorify his saints forever. It represents every persecution of the Lord's people and the blessing that follows, either on earth or in heaven, following it. Now, that's no small thing, is it, to find in this difficult chapter? Assuming that the 1,000 years of Revelation 20 and 7 represents the time of restraint of evil between the two comings of Christ, although everyone would not agree about that, the following verses in Revelation 20, 7 to 10 describe this final revolt and its ending with the banishment of the evil genius of Satan forever. Naturally, the full horror of all this coming upon Daniel had a tremendous effect upon him, as the end of our chapter says, not least because he is commanded to seal up the vision, because it concerns the distant future. So not much wonder, though, the man was exhausted and shocked to the core by what was revealed to him in his deep sleep and vision, for he had received a microcosmic sweep, a sweep throughout the whole of human history concerning the Lord's suffering saints, and the sheer magnitude of it, you see, naturally appalled the dear man as he sought to unravel its meaning in terms of near and far. Nonetheless, when he came to himself in Babylon, not Susa, he simply had to get up and attend to his normal duties as if nothing had happened. And that, you know, is how it has to be with us after breathtaking experiences. At first, after such an experience, we may feel that if all this is true and is to come, and we are to be part of it one day, we can never be ordinary again. But we can, and we must. Oh, that I could impress that upon Christians who seek to live on their spiritual nerves. It's wrong. It's wrong. After high experiences, we must learn, and God must give us grace to come down the mountain and return to what may seem very ordinary, but not without the presence of Christ, of course. But the thrill may have gone, but he hasn't gone. I say we can, and we must. This was the message which came out of Daniel chapter 8 when we studied it on a Wednesday 2 or 3 years ago. I said then, it is the fact that we are involved in such phenomenal workings of the divine will and purpose which enables us to address ourselves to the most mundane and ordinary things of life, including the kitchen sink, the workman's bench, and the secretary's and the executive's desk, and to accustom ourselves to the normal, ordinary routine of every day with supreme assurance and contentment. I suppose when a comparatively ordinary person is summoned to Buckingham Palace for an investiture to receive an honor from Her Majesty the Queen in the throne room of that amazing establishment, it must feel thereafter that it will be impossible ever to be ordinary again and to pass unnoticed in the streets. But a day or two after, and the call to duty brings us down to earth, and the great day becomes a memory. So with Daniel at the end of the chapter, which is very significant, the vision eventually went, but the reality of what was predicted would never depart, for that, you see, was etched deeply into the man's soul. So that he has here provided us with a conspectus of history, which takes in, as we have said, every age from Abraham's to the end of time. And so, like Elijah, who, you remember, went in the strength of his heavenly food for many days from Beersheba to Horeb, Daniel also is able, after a day or two, to get down to his ordinary duties. But life would never be the same again, for he would live in the light of the ultimate, and despite what that might cost, the ultimate end, which was everlasting glory. The same with us. Grow old along with me, said Browning. The best is yet to be, the last of life for which the first was made. Our times are in his hand, who saith, a whole I planned. Youth shows but half. Trust God, see all, nor be afraid. That's great, isn't it? All evil one day will be banished. It seems incredible to us today in this wicked world, but it will be. And we have to look forward to that, whatever may intervene of trial or sorrow or disaster in the meantime. We must look forward to that and learn to fix our eyes and our minds and our hearts on that, so that despite all, we become incurable optimists. The best is yet to be here and hereafter. That Wednesday when we last looked at Daniel chapter 8, I was recalling Martin Allen speaking on revival at Crieff, where many of us ministers will be tomorrow. Martin Allen of Christen Church speaking on revival at Crieff, and he quoted hymn number 210 by, notice, Jonathan Edwards' grandson, Timothy Dwight. The hymn was inspired by Psalm 137. And Psalm 137 has to do with the Jews sitting by the rivers of Babylon and weeping as they remembered Zion. But, like that psalm, the hymn, although envisaging the tears that fall and the prayers that ascend and the toils and the cares, yet with the sweetest of accents goes on to say, beyond my highest joy, I prize Zion's heavenly ways. Her sweet communion, solemn vows, her hymns of love and praise. And it goes on, Jesus, thou friend divine, our Savior and our King, the hand from every snare and foe shall great deliverance bring. Sure as thy truth shall last, to Zion shall be given the brightest glories earth can yield, and brighter bliss of heaven. Yes, we need not think that because God has wrought another great deliverance to Christendom from atheistic communism, that the deliverance which we believe must yet come to the vast nation of China, you see, will not take place. But when she shall be delivered from that burdensome yoke. And Tibet, whose agonies were being featured on television recently. You see, the Chinese intent is to wipe out Tibet's whole culture. And this is what has broken, my dear friend, broken the heart of my dear friend George Patterson, who is Edith Ingram's brother-in-law. George Patterson, as a young man, committed his life to evangelize Tibet. And I could believe that dear George's recent heart attack can be attributed partly to sheer broken-hearted grief that the land he has written so many books about and loved so intensely with the love of the Lord has been decimated and practically wiped off the face of the earth by these cruel, brutish Chinese soldiers. And yet, you know, who is more peace-loving than the Dalai Lama? He absolutely refuses to consider violence. I sometimes think that that man must be an unconscious or hidden Christian. But I was saying, we need not think that great evils are over forever. We have still Islam to contend with. What was it that one of those horrid sheikhs was saying the other day? That it might take from 10 to 20 years for all the hostages to be released. These devils, poor Terry Waite, if he has suffered anything like Jack Mann, how awful. And even if Islam is broken, which it will be one day, the devil is still able to raise another and even worse wonder of evil to plague the children of God. We cannot escape the 3.5 of persecution if we are to contemplate the other 3.5 of blessing and deliverance. They belong together. It's the cross before the crown, always. But it is the thought of the crown which must enable us to endure the cross. We must live by the crown, through the cross. And it's through the crown that we face the cross. And to be incurable optimists. What a chapter this is when we see through it to its simplicities. The simplicity of Satan's hatred of Christ and his minions' hatred of Christ's church. Incurable optimists. And I am sure that Daniel died an incurable optimist. And I believe that even poor Jeremiah, exiled in Egypt, who saw practically no fruit for his life at all down here, although he'll shine in glory like few. Poor Jeremiah, I believe, even if he died a martyr's death, like St. Paul, died an incurable optimist. Well, Stephen, the first Christian martyr, died an incurable optimist. He saw heavens open. And we have to live with the heavens open. And it's that that enables us to bear the suffering and the trial and the persecution that must come to those who love the Lord Jesus Christ. God help us all. We'll sing that beautiful hymn now, 210. Sing it thoughtfully. I love thy kingdom, Lord, the house of thine abode, the church our blessed Redeemer saved with his own precious blood. 210.